that the United States is planning long-term military relationship with emerging government of Iraq. There isn't even an emerging government to plan it with at the present time.
Such evidence as was adduced has been now shown to have been based on forgery, deception, exaggeration, hyperbole. In Washington, we don't say lies, but I'll say it, lies.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, April 21st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The retired U.S. general appointed as Iraq's post-war administrator arrived in Baghdad today, while two more top members of Saddam Hussein's regime, including his son-in-law, were reportedly captured. Landing at the Baghdad airport from Kuwait, retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner said his priority was to restore basic services, such as water and electricity, as soon as possible, a task he said would take intense work. In another development, the New York Times reported today that a scientist who claims to have worked in Iraq's chemical weapons program told a U.S. military team that Iraq destroyed and buried chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment only days before the war began, March 20th. The Times reported that members of Mobile Exploitation Team Alpha said the scientists led Americans to material that proved to be the building blocks of illegal weapons. Major General David Petraeus, commander of the Army's 101st Airborne Division, said, quote, though much work must still be done to validate the information Met Alpha has uncovered, if it proves out, it will clearly be one of the major discoveries of this operation, and it may be the major discovery. End quote. The White House had no comment. But a retired CIA agent under the Reagan administration who helped gather sensitive material on Saddam Hussein during the Reagan-Bush era says it's probably a lie. Today, Peace Watch spoke with Ray McGovern, who was a former all-sources CIA agent. He explained exactly what an all-sources CIA agent does.
Those are analysts who are in possession of all the information that there is on a specific country or a specific area. And our job was to make some sense out of it and to report daily if the information was important enough in a briefing document for the president and his chief intelligence and his chief policy advisors. So all source simply means that we were in possession of everything, public information, things from agents, things from up in the sky, things from intercepted stuff, and it was a very privileged place to be because we didn't really have to go out and seek this stuff. It was really just put in our inbox in the morning, and it was our job to make some sense out of it during the day.
Did you ever believe here in recent months and weeks that Saddam Hussein had access to weapons of mass destruction and posed enough of a threat to the U.S. that the U.S. needed to launch an invasion into that country?
The answer to your general question is no. I never believed that because the evidence was not there. Such evidence as was adduced has been now shown to have been based on forgery, deception, exaggeration, hyperbole. In Washington, we don't say lies, but I'll say it, lies.
And so if Iraq did not really pose a threat, what do you suspect was the justification or the reason for the Bush administration insisting on invading Iraq?
Well, the theory, with Hitler we had Mein Kampf, and we had Karl Marx had his own ideological justification. For us, we have something called the Project for the New American Century, which is available on their website. And you can see several years ago the policy as it has evolved, all spelled out there in terms of the necessity for us to take over Iraq and perhaps Syria and other places so that we could dominate, in our case, the world, and so that Israel could dominate the Middle East. It's not imagined, it's not contrived, it's right there in black and white, and it was written by folks like Wolfowitz, Doug Feith at Defense. Rumsfeld is a signer on to this kind of thinking, as is Dick Cheney. So you have the same folks who wrote these things now implementing that policy, and the weapons of mass destruction is just one idea that they hit on as something that they could sell this policy to the UN and to the American people. Do I expect any to be found? I think they'll find some. If they don't find some, they'll probably bring some in there to be found, but not in the numbers that would justify the charge that Iraq posed a threat to the United States.
Well, that's a pretty strong statement. Last Thursday, Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld attempted to deflect concerns that evidence could be planted to avoid embarrassment on the part of the administration around the weapons of mass destruction. Now, you were quoted in Agence France-Presse as saying, some of my colleagues are virtually certain there will be some weapons of mass destruction found, even though they may have to be planted. And so you feel strongly, you and others feel, that they will go to the extent of planting the weapons?
I would have been reluctant to mention this possibility 2 months ago. What I have watched happen, the disregard for public opinion, the arrogance. I cited Colin Powell's reaction when the forgery was discovered. That set of circumstances persuades me that this administration feels that the American people will believe pretty much anything the administration says, since they still labor under the shock of 9/11, and then what people abroad say just doesn't matter. And so let's say there are no weapons of mass destruction, that is, chemical or biological weapons, found in any quantities approximating a real threat to anyone. Okay. Well, the British are way out on a limb. Tony Blair's government could fall on this because their whole justification was to disarm Saddam Hussein from these weapons. The same with Bush. Okay, not that he's in danger of falling. Regrettably, the latest polls suggest the American people don't really care much about it.
I was going to raise that point. They've said that they don't care whether they find the weapons of mass destruction or not.
Yeah, but I think that over the longer term, the American people will be sensible enough to come around on that. But what I'm saying is that if there's a choice between finding none and planting some, and there was that conversation in Belfast a week or so ago where Blair and Bush got together, those are the kinds of venues where these things can be hatched, where these little plots can be hatched. I would not rule out, as a matter of fact, I would say it's 50-50 that the U.S. and British would conjure up a scenario where they would introduce some weapons of mass destruction and say that these were there and that's the reason we had to invade. That's a rather serious charge, and I recognize that. But as far as the U.S. is concerned, if they're found to be fabricated, found to be planted, I'm sure that Colin Powell and Rumsfeld would stiff-arm the press and say, well, if they were planted, as Powell said, well, fine, you know.
Well, now, as someone who was involved intimately in those type of inner circles and inner workings of the administration, the previous administrations, how would something like that, you said this sort of plot could be hatched at one of those meetings. Give us a glimpse of how that might manifest, how that might shape up.
Well, I have to disclaim any involvement in such plots. But I, you know, these things are incredibly sensitive. And in this, on this particular issue, when I saw Bush and Blair together in Belfast, I said, well, if this is going to be discussed, it will be discussed in a walk in the park between these two folks, and there would be agreement reached as to whether to go to this length to introduce these so-called weapons of mass destruction. And once that's done, then each of the two, Bush and Blair, would go back to their most trusted advisors and tell them to select two or three folks that would be necessary to be clued in on this, and then it would all be worked out. Now, what feeds my suspicion, of course, and it's any layman would understand this, is the way the U.S. administration is stiff-arming the U.N. Here's Inspector Blix saying, my folks will be ready to go back into Iraq in 2 weeks. Just give us the word. And here's the U.S. saying, no, thank you very much. We'll handle this. And then Rumsfeld saying, we have this chain of custody that we've carefully worked out, and so we'll know exactly where this stuff was and how it was discovered and all that stuff. Well, the chain of custody, of course, will be all U.S. folks, and that will not be credible to the world at large. Why is it that they won't give the UN a role? Well, the suspicion is that they don't want the UN to be around when nothing is found or when something is planted.
CNN is reporting that a Pentagon spokesperson said that a team of 1,000 strong from the U.S. is going in to Iraq to hunt for the weapons of mass destruction. Are you optimistic they'll find something?
Well, I think they will find something for sure. I think it will be small if it's bona fide finding. If it's planted, it's also likely to be small, but a little bit more scary, I suppose. That's how I would look at it.
Would they really be able to sneak something in?
Well, I think the burden of proof is on those to say, why is it that the U.S. will not let the U.N. accompany these folks now? I think everyone in this country should be writing to their congressman or calling them and their senator and saying, get the U.N. in on the act to find these weapons of mass destruction. If there are some there, we can hold our heads up high. If there are none, then we'll have to deal with that, but at least we will have the U.N. in on the act, and we will not have the option of letting folks plant these weapons, and, you know, we won't be going from bad to worse. So the U.N. is crucial in this role. They're the experts. They're ready to go at 2 weeks' notice. Get them in on the act.
Ray McGovern is a former All Sources CIA agent under the Bush administration, the Reagan-Bush administration, rather, and a member of VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. While the U.S. has inspection teams currently inside Iraq searching for evidence of weapons of mass destruction, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld revealed today, adding that the government would obviously look with favor on Iraqis who provide information on hidden materials. Rumsfeld declined to confirm a story that said a U.S. team had been told that Iraqis destroyed and buried chemical weapons and biological warfare equipment days before the March 20th beginning of the war. The story appeared in the New York Times, which said the information had been relayed to a government search team by an Iraqi scientist claiming to have worked in Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons program. At a Pentagon news conference, Rumsfeld had a single-word answer when asked to confirm the account. No, he said, adding a few moments later that he had nothing to add. General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, added that there are ongoing operations, there are no kidding, ongoing operations, and we're just better off not commenting. Rumsfeld also downplayed a New York Times report that the U.S. has long-term military plans to occupy Iraq.
Obviously, we're thinking about what we're going to, how we want to be arranged in the future. And in any instance, it would be a subject for discussion with countries, whether in Europe or Asia or in the Middle East. And those kinds of discussions will take place over an orderly period of time. There haven't been decisions made. There haven't been conclusions reached. And it's just a fact that the implication that as it says here, that the United States is planning long-term military relationship with emerging government of Iraq. There isn't even an emerging government to plan it with at the present time. One that would grant the Pentagon access to military bases, a subject that has not come up with anybody senior, and project American influence into the heart of the unsettled region. I mean, not so. Not so. Let me just get this off my chest. I have no idea who these people talk to. But I'll tell you, if I were a journalist, I would remember who they are, and I'd write their name down, and I would rank them right at the bottom in terms of reliability, credibility, judgment, knowledge. They are unhelpful.
U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, frustrated by Rumsfeld's seeming indifference to the plight of Iraqi civilians, activists in the nation's capital brought their message of peace to the doorstep of the Secretary of War this past weekend. Peace Watch correspondent Meredith DeFrancesco was there and files this report.
This weekend, the Atlantic Life Community, a loosely knit coalition of faith-based communities and others, marked Easter weekend with a series of actions against the war in Iraq. Saturday morning, they converged on Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's house at 2206 Kalorama Street in Washington, D.C., in a funeral procession for the Iraqi people dead at the hands of the U.S. military. Ellen Naney from High Falls, New York, was there.
We're walking around in a funeral procession past Mr. Rumsfeld's house, people carrying a coffin to signify the uncounted Iraqi dead, and a large cross. We're being led by a Buddhist bell tolling. There's costumed people symbolizing Iraqi mothers with their babies.
It is obscene that this country can name every weapon, can count every bullet, every missile, and every destructive site, but cannot name the human lives that have received these acts of destruction. A voice is heard crying in Ramah, the women weeping for their children, who are no more.
Eric Johnson from Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance in Tennessee, who just finished serving 6 months in prison for an action at the School of the Americas this past November.
A voice is heard in Basra, Mosul, and Baghdad, women refusing comfort, for their children are no more. No garland of lovely flowers can dispel the ancient grief, or silence the anguished voices who have mourned the war machine.
Those who spoke talked of the health effects of depleted uranium and the, quote, visions of empire of the unelected administration, end quote. At Prime Focus, Rumsfeld's indifference to fully assessing the numbers killed in Iraq. Long-term activist Elizabeth McAllister, wife of the late Philip Berrigan and member of Jonah House in Baltimore.
We're here finishing our Faith and Resistance retreat for Holy Week with a presence outside Rumsfeld's home. Yesterday we were at the Pentagon where he holds forth, but today we're at his home trying to bring the reality of human suffering, especially the suffering of the Iraqi people, to greater focus for him, because as he speaks of it, it all sounds so abstract and calculated and righteous. And it's not abstract, it's human beings enduring suffering we can't imagine, and death and devastation in their homes, in their lives, in their country.
A portion of the people marching on Rumsfeld had been to Iraq and made personal connections. Anne Montgomery, a nun of Religious of the Sacred Heart, has been 16 times. She says those in the Atlantic Life community are unwaveringly committed to action against war. This weekend saw 8 arrests at the Pentagon and no arrests at Rumsfeld.
We went to the Pentagon on Good Friday. It's the normal place we go on Good Friday because we feel that it's a source of so much of this, the planning by people who do not come face-to-face with their victims. The first day, people went to the Naval Arms Bazaar, and these arms bazaars take place a couple of times a year at least. There's an Army one, I guess Air Force, but it's just obscene that this should be treated like the sale of commercial things, that we are selling our weapons to other nations and just inviting people in almost in a celebratory way. Come and buy, come and buy.
And into plowshares turn their swords. Nations shall learn war no more. And into plowshares turn their swords. Nations shall learn war no more.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Meredith DeFrancesco with help from Scott Gurian.
In an unusual show of unity that marked the first Middle East regional forum in the wake of the Iraq War, Iraq's neighbors, including Turkey, Iran, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and Bahrain, unanimously called on the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq as soon as an Iraqi government is established. The foreign ministers' weekend meeting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, categorically rejected U.S. threats against Syria and opposed a U.S. call to lift United Nations sanctions on Iraq, saying it must be allowed to have a government of its own first. Ula Ferawati reports.
Increasingly defiant over America's aggressive new posture in the Middle East and worried about the security of their own countries, Iraq's neighbors said over the weekend in Saudi Arabia that they would not accept a long-term U.S. role in Iraq. The eight countries also threw their collective weight behind Syria and its mounting confrontations with the U.S. and expressed concern for Iran. Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal.
We have to have a unified vision that will be the base of our dealing with the new situation, and a unified voice when talking to the world. We meet here with no hidden agendas whatsoever. We are concerned about the interests of Iraq and the Iraqi people. We affirm that Iraq is for the Iraqi people, and we affirm the unity and security of Iraq. We ask the occupation forces to adhere to the Geneva Convention by safeguarding Iraq's culture and making sure that all that was looted is returned back to the Iraqi people.
Dr. Abdul Khaliq Abdullah, professor of political science at the United Arab Emirates University, believes the meeting was not necessary.
This meeting does not affect anything going on in Iraq or the political decision in Washington. These countries' ability to affect things is too little to be mentioned. The new Iraq will be formed by two powers only, the U.S. and the Iraqi people who achieved their freedom. The Riyadh meeting of countries neighboring Iraq might be important for these countries themselves, but not really for anything in Iraq.
There's a heated discussion all around the Arab world about the shape of a post-Saddam Hussein administration in Baghdad. Many are skeptical that the Iraqis would be able to decide on a democratic government soon. But Dr. Abdullah says the future is promising.
I am optimistic despite the looting taking place right now. I am optimistic because the Iraqi people are aware and conscious of their freedom and are practicing this through demonstrations and calls to end the American occupation. These demonstrations are saying no to occupations and yes to a unified Iraq. This makes one optimistic that Iraq won't allow occupation and these people will be able to control their country very soon.
Some critics believe that Iraq's ethnic and religious diversity hinders its ability to form an independent unified government. Dr. Abdullah said this cannot prevent Iraq from becoming a democratic country.
This is a pluralistic society like any society in the world. Despite its ethnic and religious differences, this is normal and healthy. All countries with similar populations are able to live securely because of the enforcement of law and order. The proper environment for pluralism to survive and flourish is there.
In Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, this is Ola Farawati for Pacifica's Peace Watch.
As media coverage of the invasion of Iraq is reduced to the triumphant, almost jubilant refrains of the Pentagon and President Bush, activists are bewildered by the lack of U.S. debate. Can any Democrat stand on a populist platform and stop the course of U.S. imperialism in Iraq and now Syria? Has the political spectrum been so distorted by civic passivity? We present now the second part of a speech recently given by MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky in Boulder, Colorado.
You've talked tonight about what was done by this administration and by some of the same people during Reagan-Bush, and you've also criticized Clinton, but not so much tonight. And I'm wondering how important it would be to try to work for the change from the Republicans to the Democrats in the next election, which is, you know, it's a measurable change.
Well, it depends what the Democrats are. I actually did talk about Clinton. So the sanctions that have destroyed Iraq and strengthened Saddam Hussein and made the population dependent on him and prevented an internal revolt, that's Clinton. Back in the 1960s, the only way you could prevent a populist movement was a military coup. Now you can do it by the mechanisms of what the world calls neoliberalism, financial markets, the international financial markets can strangle them. Capital can flow out of the country. What's called by economists a virtual parliament of investors and lenders can make the actual decisions over what happens in a country. Its own voters are irrelevant. The virtual parliament does it. Yeah, that's thanks to the what's called globalization, the measures that have been introduced in the last 30 years, primarily much of it under Clinton, which means that a lot of that is thanks to Clinton. Those are other ways of controlling people. I mean, you know, they might have alternatives, but they'd have to be almost revolutionary by now. That's what the global justice movements are about, trying to prevent the virtual parliament from destroying what's left of democracy by transferring power into the hands of the virtual parliament. Okay, we ought to know about those things, too, and plenty of people do. That's why there's a big global justice movement. That's Clinton, too, and there's more. Going back to your question, it's really hard to say. You know, it depends what the alternatives actually are. That's why I was quoting Dean Acheson, Kennedy administration, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The spectrum is pretty narrow. It's not to say that it doesn't exist, and sometimes choices within it are important, but far more important than that is changing the spectrum. And the way you do that is by the kinds of activism that have changed the country. That changes the spectrum within which choices are going to be made. Ultimately, you want to go beyond that, but for the short term, that's, I think, what has to be done.
Radical extreme statists such as Bush and company must share a basic sense of self-preservation, a dangerous course that they've initiated. Do these people believe that they'll escape by magic or by divine intervention? Yeah. Or does their extreme devotion to ideology prevent ordinary logical thinking?
And, it's logical.
And finally, is it important for us or not to understand what's going on in their minds if we want to change the world?
No, I don't think so. It's minor importance. The reason it's of minor importance is that this is close to a historical universal. You know, it happens that by now the stakes are much greater because the means of violence are so much greater. You take a look at history, it's been like this forever. You take a look at the history of war. I mean, very often, maybe like half the time, wars were started by countries who got destroyed. Well, the leadership was willing to take the chance, you know. I mean, and it's not just recent. You know, people talk about the 20th century as the most horrible century ever, and in some ways it was. But you look at the wars in Europe, the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, it wiped out about 40% of the population of Germany. You know, they kept at it. You know, the leadership was just more important. You're interested in short-term power, profit, and gain. And the fact that it might destroy your country is kind of secondary. And that goes right through history, you know, except the main difference now is that the stakes are much higher, much higher. But the reasoning is pretty constant. So is it important to think what's in the minds of these particular guys? Yeah, maybe at some level, but it's more important to recognize that, you know, within a lunatic framework, decisions are made which are pretty rational. It's the framework that's lunatic. Think about what you're taught in your economics courses. That's right. You know, it's rational within a framework of thinking that's pretty much accepted. People are supposed to be rational wealth maximizers. Well, and the market, if it works perfectly in theory, is supposed to respond to the inputs from the participants. So your votes are your dollars, and your goal is maximizing your wealth. Okay, here's a simple question. How many votes do your grandchildren have in the market? None. You know, they don't vote in the market. Therefore, their interests are valued at zero in what's called rational behavior. So therefore, it's entirely rational to destroy the possibility that of a world in which they can survive if you can have more shoes. You know, it's essentially what it comes down to. It's a kind of a rational decision with a framework of complete lunacy, you know. And there's a lot in history that's like that. Now, we should be concerned with those lunatic frameworks much more than what's in the mind of some person who's making decisions within them that may be pretty rational within an accepted framework.
MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky is speaking recently in Boulder, Colorado. Thanks to Pacifica affiliate station KGNU for providing that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. ¶¶